public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Jan, would you tell us what this is about, and then we'll ask Senator Perry to explain the need for us here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 11 is here at the request, I believe, of Senator Farioli and the superintendent of Duper. There are two ways to organize school districts. There are common school districts, and there are county unit school districts. And the merger and boundary change laws are different. And under a common school district, let's say you have two districts next to each other, you would need a vote of the majority of each district. But in a county unit school district, you just need a majority of everybody. So in essence, if a big district was interested in taking over a little district, they could probably do so against the little district's will. So Senate Bill 11 was drafted to basically repeal the county unit school districts. So in essence, that's it.
Thank you. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our staff. Not bad, really. Not bad. when this issue came before us last year, it actually was driven more or less out of the Revenue Committee. We were looking at different impacts in the potential for consolidation, forced consolidation of school districts. And there was some discussion in the Dallas School District to merge a couple of different smaller school districts, and there was actually some initiative petitions to do that. One, I think, was defeated at the polls. But it came to attention of several people that there were two tracks to merge school district. One was voluntary, where both the small district with an affirmative vote and the large district with an affirmative vote could effect a voluntary merger. And that seemed to be a more genteel and respectful way of consolidating to control costs and to deliver services. There was an archaic statute on the books that just said this essentially is social Darwinism, and the big district could just decide to merge the small district in the form of hostile takeover. That statute had not been used in Oregon for many years until this initiative in the Dalles area, which was defeated. And at that point in time, we just decided, look, the rules of engagement ought to be a single track, and it ought to take into consideration the needs of the smaller community, which oftentimes are economic needs, and they're driven by the exigency of budgets and dwindling, sometimes dwindling, student base, and the needs of the larger district to be responsive to the community and provide efficiency. So they have eventually reasons to agree with each other that have to do with self-interest. And that should drive these mergers, not the decision of the larger district simply to force its will on the smaller district. When I submitted this bill for drafting, I expected that I would get just a one-page bill back, which had one or two Oregon revised statute sites. And instead, Ms. Hunt chose to draft a bill that would be more sweeping in scope, simply eliminating the concept of county school districts. And that, of course, also takes with it the concept that I described, where a smaller district could be taken over in a hostile takeover, because the statutes that authorize that are buried within the county school district statutes. Ms. Hunt absolutely, positively, without question, assures me that there's no consequences that are unforeseen or unintended by changing the names of these county school districts to conform with all the other districts that we have in the state of Oregon. So I would invite the folks from Chenoweth to come and talk about their issue and why we're here. And I will tell the chairman of the committee that there's been several conferences about a number of issues in the bill, including the meaning of the word shall and will, which are at one time an issue in the context of this bill. Shall not and will not are synonymous. That we've determined by a couple of discussions. We have had a number of folks express concerns about the bill, and in every one of those instances, we've referred those concerns to legislative counsel who've been able to discuss those concerns and allay the fears that were generated. So far, every one of them have primarily been misinterpretations or misunderstanding about the net effect of the bill. I continue to believe that this bill is a good bill and a necessary one. I continue to believe that the consequences are not unforeseen. But I continue to check each and every single time I hear somebody raise an issue, we go back and go through the statute with the drafter of the bill in legislative council to make sure that there are no unforeseen consequences. So I sit before you, Mr. Chairman, convinced this is a good and necessary bill that has no unforeseen consequences.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Martin.
I'm not sure where in the process we'll do this. We do have people to testify. Okay. At some point, though, I would appreciate it if Senator Farioli would tell us what the concerns were, just to give us some idea of the kinds of questions that were raised.
I can do that now, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like. In Grant County, for instance, which is a county school district, it's not a county school district, it's a unified school district, they're the only county that still can access a statute that provides that excess road funds over and above the surpluses and the needs projected can be transferred to the school district. They had a concern. This bill does not affect their ability. A couple of other folks expressed concern that that changing the name from county school district somehow affected their authority to operate as a school district or made them subject to statutes that they were not already subject to, and that turns out not to be the case. Some thought that they had authorities granted to county school districts that didn't exist for other school districts, and the only ones that we are attempting to affect is this antique merger statute. So those are the three concerns that I heard so far, and those were slapped down with logical arguments and empirical arguments made by Ms. Hunt, who drafted the bill. And Senator, I assure you that if there's a flaw in this bill, I'll be one of the first ones that wants to root it out and make sure that we're not doing anything that we don't intend to do.
Thank you very much. With that, we will call the witnesses up. Jack Henderson, you had some folks with you. Yes. Please come up. I believe you signed Ellen as witnesses already on the witness list.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Jack Henderson. I'm the superintendent of the Duper School District. And I just, as Senator Farioli stated earlier, I was the one that made probably the most noise in speaking to Senator Farioli about this issue in our school district. And more than that, this issue statewide for small school districts. The Duper School District is a small K-12 school district 13 miles south of the Dalles. We currently have 273 students in our district. We're very proud of our past and look forward to our future. A year ago is when I first learned about ORS 333. There was a disgruntled group of people in the Dalles, the population center of Owasco County, who for many reasons decided that they thought they wanted to have the development of a countywide school district in Owasco County to save resources, monies, and those things. And through that, it became apparent to us that we virtually had no control of that situation at all, because to make that happen, 5% of the registered voters signed a petition, which gets it on the ballot instantly, and then, or not instantly, certainly the next election, and then at the next election, if the majority, the simple majority of the people in the county approve the measure, then it becomes, the new district is formed, which it really puts small school districts in peril, particularly at this point in time, as you know, we all know and hear continually about the funding problems in the school districts, and although I would guess that certainly in our situation, our school districts are financially sound as districts are around the state at this point in time, and certainly we need to have local control to continue to do that. And that's the curious thing about ORS 333 being on the statute since, I believe, 1959. We've been unable to find a district in the state of Oregon, a countywide school district formed through this statute. It it is not fair, and in my mind, not good policy for the state of Oregon. Luckily, through a strong grassroots effort in Wasco County, the measure was narrowly defeated. The two smallest districts in Wasco County are Duper and the South Wasco County School District, which is 30 miles south of Duper. In those districts, 90% of the people voted against this measure, and that is the reason that we barely tipped the scales and defeated it. My fear is that in the future, as you know, with the projected revenue shortfall still staring us in the face and really no end in sight to our economic plight, that the folks could again bring this back and maybe put us in a weaker position at that point in time, because the best people to run a small school district are the folks in the town, local decision-making power, and that is why we requested that this bill be developed. Talked to Senator Gray earlier about that, and Delegate Cindy Hunt has developed the bill, and there have been a couple of concerns that we've heard, and I'm very confident that we'll be able to work through those as we have in the initial ones that we've heard.
Yes.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me a little bit about the other school district that's south, that other small school district. Where is that around Antelope, Antelope.
Antelope. Actually, I believe Antelope is on the far corner of the school. The South Wasco County School District is on Shenico, that area would be on the southeast corner of the...
Okay, so how many students in that district?
They're a lot like us. They have around 260, 270 students.
And where is the school located?
The school is located in the community of Moffitt.
Oh, my?
Yeah.
Oh.
The hub of activity
okay.
The Deschutes River.
Right. Okay.
Winter playgrounds or summer playgrounds and all that. But they're in both districts in Wasco County are very proud of their past. And as I said, looking forward to the future with not just dread of funding things and feeling the need to have the local control to actually chart the course of education in our communities into the future. Because, for instance, in Wasco County, if the countywide school district would have been formed, South Wasco County School would have been, whatever form it would have taken, it would have been 60 miles from the population center of the district. Now, they're not going, certainly a lot of concerns about not being able, not receiving the same services that they're used to.
Thank you, Sir Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent, for traveling what should be at least some distance, a decent distance to get here, and thank you. The one question that I have, and you kind of touched upon it in your testimony, how would you answer the concern that the small districts that by consolidating, or the opportunities that we might have by consolidating, would just bring about inherent cost efficiencies?
I would answer in this way. Small school districts, Duper included, typically pay less than the surrounding school districts. I think that's true statewide, and it's certainly true in our school district. The thing that we heard people talking about, that we need less administration. Anytime we talk about saving money, we need less administration. Well, in the Duper School District, there's one superintendent, myself, and one kindergarten through 12th grade principal. That is the administration of the school district. And we're very proud at this point in time that the Duper School District, through an incredibly well-managed fiscal situation through the life of the district, we have significant cash reserves, and we have programs that the other school districts don't have. And that was one of the curious things last year through the campaign for development of the Wasco, the countywide school district in Wasco County, is that folks were saying that, well, all students need to have these programs. Well, in the Duper School District, we have K-12 Spanish education for our students. We have K-12 physical education. We have K-12 music. We have the programs that the other districts don't have simply because of the conservative nature that the district's been managed in through the years. And that's how I answer the question of the efficiencies, because what we looked at through the in arguing against the formation of the countywide school district in Wasco County is if what a countywide school district would have been formed, everybody's salaries in the district would have raised to a point that it jumped up, the expense would have jumped up like $200,000 instantly from where it was to run the Duper building, if in fact the Duper building was ran. And the Duper High School has currently have 92 students in Duper High School, and we have a wide array of electives, AP courses, and those things, more so than the neighbors to our neighbors to the north. And the fear is, in a we talk about we're going to form a countywide school district to make it better, more fiscally more responsible. People will say that in arguing, and I would say just the opposite. It's actually going to cost more. Because then you get into a situation where the school is closed. Duper High School is 13 miles south of the Dalles. Well, we can bus those students to the Dalles High School. Well, you know, is Duper High School not being fiscally responsible and educationally responsible to the students of the district? And the answer is yes, they are. And they should be allowed to continue that into the future. It's a long answer to a short question.
Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the to answer some of the concerns about unintended consequences, we produced the Dash 1 amendments. And the Dash 1 amendments added a section after Section 1. The Section 1 indicates that the county school district that exists on the effective date of the act shall discontinue as a county school district. And Section 2 under that indicates that on or after the effective date of the Act, all laws that apply to common school districts shall apply to school districts that existed as county school districts prior to the effective date of the Act. So by making a modification, we preserved the statutory requirements and protections for the school districts that had existed as county school districts, but we renamed them and repackaged them as common school districts and eliminated this 1950s version of the hostile takeover in the process. So we did address their concerns. I don't think we have unintended consequences in this bill.
Thank you. Any further? None. Let's hear from our other witnesses, please. Who's next?
I'm Janelle Wyatt. I'm a
would you bring the microphone around to you?
I'm Janelle White. I'm a patron of the Duper School District. I have one daughter that's in college now that went through Duper Schools and another in high school, 16-year-old in high school. And I'm just going to read my letter because this makes me very nervous. So, ORS 333 is an unfair, poorly written law, and I'm asking you to vote yes on Senate Bill 11 to remove it from the books for the following reasons. Number one, there is a well-thought-out and well-written law on the books, ORS 330, that allows school districts to merge. It is equitable to all schools involved and has been used in almost all mergers of school districts in Oregon. Number two, the bad law, as I call it, ORS 333, allows for a large school district to take over a smaller district with a simple majority vote. In our case, this law would have allowed the merger of four school districts in our county, two small rural districts, and two larger districts in the Dalles with absolutely no plan, no fiscal impact study, nothing in writing to show that this would even save any money. Like other small districts around the state, we pride ourselves on wise fiscal planning even when times are tough. There's little staff turnover because Duper is a good school with responsible leadership, small class sizes, and the school is the hub of the community. Because the control and decisions for the limited resources available for schools has been local, the Duper community has worked hard to support the local school district. A merger using ORS 333 would probably have closed our small high school with an added tax burden of a bond to build a mega high school to house all the students in Wasco County. This is the wrong direction to go. We chose to live in a small community with a small school, so our children would have an opportunity to play sports, know their teachers on a personal level, participate in a wide variety of extracurricular activities, and be part of a community of young and old alike that care about them. I'm sure there are others in bigger cities that like the larger schools for their own reasons. They should not be able to force my children to go to a large school, just as I should not be able to force their children to go to a small school. please vote yes and remove ORS 333 from the books so that all Oregonians will continue to have the opportunity to choose what they want for their children's public education. Number three, I feel like it's the wrong direction to go. Good public policy strengthens rural communities. We should try to narrow the divide between rural and urban Oregon, not widen it. Decisions and dollars need to stay as close to where we live as possible. Through frugal budgeting, careful long-term planning, and strong community support, our school district has been able to provide a quality education for our young people in both good times and bad times. And number four, I always believe that students should come first. For students, bigger schools and bigger class sizes are rarely better. Do for Schools has a proven track record in the state of Oregon. Check out their school report card on the ODE website, and I attached a copy of that with my letter. You can also check out their website, www.dofer.k12.ors, if you can't fit a personal visit into our to our school into your busy schedule. There's a low dropout rate in the high school. Many graduates from Dofer High School do very well in colleges and universities around the country, and many former students move back to Dofer so their children can have the same opportunities. I'd just like to thank you in advance for your yes vote on this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Very compelling testimony. Thank you. And Michelle.
My name is Michelle Hamill, and I'm a citizen of Dofer. I also am a graduate alumni of Dofer High School. My husband and I chose to move back to the Dofer community to raise our children. I have a daughter who is a junior and a son who is in seventh grade. So you can see the potential merger or consolidation or hostile takeout over however you want to put it really upset me. I didn't want my daughter graduating from the Dallas High School. Janelle and I were part of the grassroots that tried to, or that we were successful in stopping the ballot measure. I have a letter that I will read too because I get a little nervous speaking to people that I don't know. It starts, ORS 333 is unfair and should not be used to acquire a smaller school district for their tax base and students. As in ORS 330, any talk of consolidation should come from the smaller district first. How would Oregonians feel if California decided to acquire Oregon? And even if we all voted no, their majority voting power voted yes and it passed. That's how we felt. ORS 333 allows a simple majority vote that is inherently unfair. It is similar to a hostile takeover. The countywide statute only generates ill feelings and distrust. It will make any action by a new board the subject of a prolonged battle, in essence, another 100 years war over education. Good public policy strengthens rural communities. Decisions and dollars need to stay as close as possible to where we live. Schools are major assets in the small communities, and decisions about the school should be made in those small communities. ORS 333 has the potential of imposing the will of the disinterested majority upon a motivated and caring minority. The small school patrons have worked hard to be supportive of their schools, both in physical plant and curriculum. To have a larger population base vote to take away the rights of the small districts just because they have more voting power is a sorry and unfair turn of events. Schools are not just about students, but about community support and involvement. Recent studies show that students are best served by having a bond with their communities. That is what makes this country's small schools great. In small schools, the success of both the academic and sports programs are evident to everyone in the community. It is also a place where teachers know the parents by name, and you can be personally involved. Our rural communities have pride and ownership in our schools by supporting them with our taxes and also with our involvement in the school and community activities. ORS 333 allows for the bully on the block to take over with a simple majority vote. All it takes is one disgruntled district patron and a petition. I am requesting that you assist the small school districts in the state by revisiting ORS 333 and removing it from the books. I would hate to have another community go through the issue like we had to. ORS 333 can easily be removed, and it won't cost the taxpayers any money. Let's make this a win-win situation for the state of Oregon and education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Senator Morissette.
I guess I feel like the small school is an economic development engine that brings people to the community, because I can't imagine a company settling in a place that doesn't have a good school. And I graduated from, I think there were 30 in my graduating class. So I understand what can happen in a small school that doesn't happen in a large school. So I, the other issue, I guess, is that I would like to try to be protective of the distribution formula, which so much has been written about lately, because I don't want the small schools to lose money through a redistribution through the formula. So I'm not sure where we're going to be on that, but I think we need to protect the small schools.
Thank you. We think so also. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I comment from the chair. I am aware that comments you made early on really are reflective of most small districts, and that's frugality. The fact that faculty, because they're part of the community, so much part of the community, are willing quite often to work for less. They, in fact, are paid less. When we went through this forced mergers this last decade, we saw many small schools where administrators and teachers got substantial raises because of the forced mergers. And as you have pointed out, that certainly most likely would have happened hadn't there been a forced merger in your county. So, Superintendent Henderson, you indicated that you were contacting Klamath School District,
correct?
It's my belief that this committee is ready to pass this bill out based on the evidence and the testimony. I'm concerned that we do that, but I'm also willing to wait a week, hear back from you.
In case you change your mind.
I am... Senator Perio.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I too think that, although it doesn't seem like it, this is the relaxed portion of our legislative session. We haven't felt like that in our committees. We feel like we're all just running really hard. But I think it would be an excellent idea to allay anyone's concerns that there's an unintended consequence here. So I would applaud that approach. I would like to just assure the folks on the committee that when Senate Bill 11 was in draft form, I shopped it by Mr. Rose and Mr. Mitchell, and neither have expressed any concern about this bill. They both looked at the text and understood what it was doing, and they have not registered any questions or concerns or opposition. But there remains still some districts who just want to be absolutely certain. And I think we have the luxury of time to make certain. So let's do make certain.
I would be ready to act today, but that's fine. I'll wait.
Well, as I said, I think we're ready to vote this out. But I also believe that, as Senator Perio points out, we do have time, and we're not under pressure. So I'm going to close the public hearing. And I'm sorry. There was another witness that wanted to speak. So we'll excuse the panel of witnesses here. And Jean, would you come forward? I see your card here, but I didn't see that was on the witness list.
All right.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson, Associate Director for Governmental Affairs with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I see that you're all convinced, and I wouldn't want to upset that, but I did want to just add a little bit of testimony to the record, if I could. The Oregon Farm Bureau is supportive of Senate Bill 11. We're very supportive of rural schools in the state. I am also a graduate from Duffer Grade School and Duffer High School. I was a graduate of a class of 14. At that time, the entire high school had a student body of 55. And I cannot even begin to describe all the benefits that I received from graduating from that school and the opportunities that it has given me. I applied to go to college at Willamette University, and my interview consisted of, with a department head, it consisted of a conversation about my rural school experiences and playing a gig on my saxophone, which might have been kind of unusual, but graduating from Duffer, it had such a strong musical program. I was playing piano and saxophone from the time, I don't know, I was in fourth grade probably, so it was no big deal to pull out my saxophone and play a tune for the department head at a university, I guess, but it did work out well because I was asked to play in the Willamette University Jazz Band as one of three saxophone players, which in the music community is a good jazz group. Then I was able to move on and receive my Juris Doctorate degree at Lewis and Clark Northwestern School of Law. And again, I think it was to my advantage to graduate. I come from a small community, a rural community, and from a small school because it was told to me that they wanted to diversify their student body and make sure that they had students at that law school that were from small communities and small schools. So again, there are many other benefits that I've received through life, through my education, certainly from graduating. So I'm a big supporter, and I too was upset and emotional when this measure came up and was voted on. And luckily, due to the very hard work from the small school districts and from Duffer School, as you've heard, it was defeated by a slim margin. But it really caused a lot of divisiveness amongst the both communities that was probably unnecessary. If there would have been a fair structure for an election process put into place in the first place, maybe we wouldn't have had to go through all that. It really cost both communities a lot of resources and a lot of money and a lot of relationships that, again, was unnecessary. So Senate Bill 11 puts a fairness factor into place that currently isn't there, and we are fully in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. With that, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 11, and we'll set it over for work session at a later time. Opening the informational meeting, update on charter schools, and I'm going to bring Rob Kramer up first. Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having the chance to talk to you today about the goings-on in Oregon vis-a-vis Oregon's charter school law. If I could describe Oregon's charter school movement in a word, I would say it's vigorous. It's very active. There are, I think, upwards of 30 individual charter school development projects happening right now all over the state of Oregon, and it is in every corner of the state of Oregon. It's not just the urban Willamette Valley school districts. It's all over the place in rural school districts, in suburban school districts, and in the urban school districts. I am the president of the Oregon Charter School Service Center, and in that role I have the privilege of working with charter school development teams all over the state and helping them in their journey, and it is a journey, starting a new public charter school in Oregon. It's very rewarding work because it puts me in touch with parents, with teachers, with community groups who have made it their vision, sometimes their professional vision, to start a new public school in Oregon based upon a model that they care very deeply about. One of the projects that we're currently involved in is in Ontario, Oregon. A project started by two teachers, Shell and Jose. They have an idea for a charter school in the Ontario School District, a district with 37% of its kids are non-English speaking, mostly Hispanic. Jose Melendez knows firsthand what it's like to come to this country without speaking English. He came 30-some years ago as a 19-year-old from Mexico with no money, spoke no English. He worked in the fields for a few years in and around Boise and Ontario, and then went to community college and got his GED. Bootstrapped his way up into college, got his teaching certificate, and spent 20 years teaching in the Ontario School District. And during that time, he developed a model for a school program, which they call a dual immersion model. It has kids taught half-time in English and half-time in Spanish, not just the Hispanic kids, but also the English-speaking kids. They piloted this model in their elementary school in Ontario, and it was so successful, a waiting list of 40 parents to get their children into the school. He and his partner teacher, Shell, decided to start a charter school based on this model. Well, Jose knows one thing, coming from Mexico to America. He knows that it's absolutely vital that everybody have mastery of the English language, and especially those kids who don't come from a family who speaks English. And he's proven that he knows how to do that. He knows how to teach these kids to speak English, and as a side benefit, he knows how to teach the English-speaking kids to speak Spanish at the same time. And it is tremendously rewarding to help people like that achieve their professional vision in a public school here in Oregon. And we have the charter school law to thank for the fact that Shell and Jose have the freedom to start that kind of a school here in Oregon. I first testified before this committee on the topic of charter schools back in 1997. And I look back at that time, that was a dream far away when we might have 23 operating charter schools in Oregon with maybe a dozen more on the way for next fall. I'd say we have a law here in Oregon that is working very well. Yes, there are fits and starts to it. Yes, there are some struggles in getting a charter school open from both the charter school side and from the sponsor side. But we have a law that's working, and I think that there are some people we can thank for that. One of them is the Oregon School Boards Association. Another is the Oregon Department of Education. We have forged a relationship between the three groups, the charter starter groups, the Department of Ed, and the Oregon School Boards Association, that literally is unique in the nation. I can say this for a fact because I have contacts all over the country in the charter school movement of the 40 or so states that have a charter school law. Oregon is the only state that has a school boards association that has supported the charter school law. One. The only state. Our Department of Education has also done a very good job in honestly and fairly implementing the terms of the statute as passed. And so because of that, and because we have worked together over the last 3 years since this law passed, we have a law that I think is working quite well. And we need to continue with those successes. We've had some recent milestones in the charter school law here in Oregon, too. One very recent, just a couple of weeks ago, the state sponsored its first state-chartered charter school, the Victory School in the Portland School District. Now, that's a milestone because one of the elements of this law, as you probably remember, is that we needed to have a secondary route to sponsorship for those isolated circumstances in which a school district perhaps did not deal fairly or in good faith with the charter proposal. We needed some kind of a backstop. After 3 years of the law, one charter school proposal did make it all the way through that process, and the state voted unanimously at its last State Board of Education meeting to sponsor this school. Now that, I think, is a milestone because it will send a signal to districts that might not really support the charter concept, and if they have a charter school proposed in their district, might prefer it to go away and perhaps drag their feet a little bit, that they better deal fairly with a charter school proposal. Otherwise, the state is ready and willing to sponsor a school that has not been dealt with in good faith by the school district. I'm happy to say, however, that most school districts are honestly and fairly implementing this law. It is only isolated cases where we're seeing school districts perhaps are not. And so I wouldn't say it's a general problem, and I'm happy to be able to report that. I'm happy to be able to report we're not seeing broad-based and broad-scale foot-dragging by school districts. They're going along. Some may or may not like it very much, but some school districts, to their credit, are seeing charter schools as a way that they can better serve their own clients. And they're embracing the charter school law and the capabilities that it gives them and using it for the advantage that they know it gives them, and that is to serve their students, to serve their clientele. One of those school districts is Paisley School District, a rural school district that has made the decision to investigate whether they can charter their only school as a charter school. Now, what does that win them? In the charter school law, it says that every school in a district shall not be a charter school. So a district cannot charter every single school in this district. But there's an exclusion in the statute that says, notwithstanding, a school district made up of one school can charter that one school. Now, Paisley School District is a school district of one school. It has been burdened by what it considers excessive state regulations, things that don't apply to a school district of its size. For instance, you must have, according to state mandate, a certified librarian in your school district. Well, this is a very small school district, and it doesn't have the funds to have a certified librarian. If they don't, then they are a non-standard school district, and the state has the option to declare them such and take them over and disband their school board. Now, obviously, that's not something Paisley School District wants. It wants the autonomy to keep its own school. By turning its school district, its only school, into a charter school, it gets out from under those mandates that were written for school districts that are much bigger than it. And so it's pleasing to me, 3 years after the law passed, 6 full years after I first started testifying to this committee, and about 9 full years after I started working on this issue, that we're seeing entire school districts perhaps be saved by having a charter school law here in Oregon. It's my understanding that the Oregon School Boards Association is going to have a bill that will make it easier for districts like Paisley to go down the path and turn themselves into a charter school. I think Jim Green will probably discuss that a little bit later. There's some technicalities in the law that make it unreasonably hard for a single school district to do that. We will be supporting that bill. I would call it a short agenda for this session on technical adjustments to the charter school bill. I hope the committee will be looking at a bill that has these elements incorporated. One is to adjust the audit requirements for charter schools. Charter schools are small nonprofit organizations, yet the charter law, and I think by mistake, said that it must have a municipal audit or that it must comply with municipal audit rules, as if these were municipalities and used fund accounting as opposed to financial accounting standards for its books. I would like to change that language to require a financial audit as opposed to a municipal audit for the charter schools. We fully support the notion that every charter school should have an annual audit. That audit should be open to the public and sent to its sponsors and to the state. We're not trying to escape any kind of financial or fiscal accountability, but I do think it's unreasonable to have that audit requirement be a municipal audit, which is very expensive and puts it through a procedural framework that simply does not apply to a small nonprofit corporation like charter schools tend to be. Number two, I think we should look at the PERS requirement for charter schools. Do we think charter schools should be required to be members or their employees pay into PERS? This issue came up with the McCoy Academy Charter School in Portland. Every single employee of the school signed an affidavit saying they did not want the PERS benefit because they knew if they had that benefit, it would reduce their health care benefit and some other and their salary. And we see this happening with lots of charter schools. They would prefer not to pay into PERS and to have their own defined contribution pension plan. And I think it's a discussion that would be good to have. There is a move in the building, obviously, in the overall context of PERS reform, to perhaps allow municipalities to opt out of PERS entirely. And charter schools are not a municipality, but the public policy question of should they be allowed to opt out is a discussion I would like to have. And finally, we're seeing in some isolated circumstances around the state, school districts that are able to manipulate the administrative rules and the statute in order to drag their feet and hope, it appears to be, they hope to run out the clock on some charter projects that they would prefer not succeed. And whether or not there's a legislative fix or there should be a legislative fix to this problem, I kind of doubt. I don't like to change statute every time there's a problem with the implementation of the statute. But that being said, I do think it's good for the committee to know when there are circumstances of a district that's using nuances in a statute in order to not fully implement that statute. And I would be happy to discuss with any one of you individually where this is going on, exactly how they're doing it, and sometimes a strategically placed phone call to the appropriate person in these organizations is really all it needs in order to get something out of a process and moving along. And so I won't be...
Senator Eggert.
Thank you. Just how does the statute read, Rob, in that respect? My memory is not clear enough on how it reads with... There are day aren't there day requirements?
Mr. Chair, as Senator Deckard, the statute, once a charter school is proposed, the district has 60 days in order to hold a hearing. But that clock does not start ticking until that proposal is deemed to be complete. That is, has it addressed every element in the law that it's supposed to address? Mm-hmm. And that is 15 business days, mm-hmm. and that... They have to communicate with the charter proposers that it is or it is not complete. That's an administrative rule, that's not in the statute. That's where we're seeing the foot dragging. They've submitted a 300-page proposal that clearly substantially addresses every required element, but the district is able to just say, no, it has not, and there's a sometimes 5-month back and forth trying to fully address all of these concerns before the district even says, okay, now it's a complete proposal, and now we can go down the path. And that's where we're seeing the foot dragging on the front end.
Yeah. Senator Morissette.
Well, could there be good reasons for looking at the proposal, a 300-page proposal, and say, you know, we need to talk about this? Now, are you saying that in that situation, when does the clock stop? The clock does not start, until they say it's a complete proposal. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, that is correct. When they say it's a complete proposal, then is the time, the 60 days in which the district reviews the proposal for not whether it's complete, but whether it thinks the quality of the proposal is strong enough.
Okay. Well, then I think it's reasonable to get the complete proposal. Then if there's foot dragging after that, and now, are you talking about foot dragging after that, or are you saying that that's part of the foot dragging?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, the foot dragging I'm specifically referring to is in the 15-day period in which they say whether or not the proposal is complete. The 60 days to have the public hearing has not been a problem, and everything proceeds fairly smoothly after that. But it's in that 15 days when a district, if it wants to drag its feet, can unilaterally claim, no, this proposal is not complete, and you have to...
Clarification.
Yeah. Okay. I understand what the problem is. I can understand the foot dragging, but I guess I don't quite understand if a district says I don't understand what you are attempting to do here, so it is not complete. Please explain that. Now that could go on for a while. If it's a 300 page document, I could see some of that going on for a while. A back and forth about what do you mean by this, what do you mean by that. Now, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I can too. I think there are legitimate reasons for a district to say, no, the law requires you address curriculum and what curriculum you'll use in your proposal, but you have not addressed that at all, or you've given a very short shrift, so please beef it up. I fully support that. Yeah. We're seeing more, we kind of liken it to if I sell you a car with no tires, that is an incomplete car. If I sell you a car with worn tires, that's a complete car, and now we can judge the quality of the tires on that car. Mm-hmm. That's what we have the 60-day hearing period for. But the car is complete. So what we are seeing is the district's two things. The district's and this is isolated. I'm not saying this is broad-based. But some districts are requiring things to be in the proposal that are not required in statute, simply not required in statute. Mm-hmm. And that is not unfair. And number two, some districts are claiming that the treatment of a subject is not up to their standard, which is a determination more appropriately done in the hearing period of 60 days, not in just saying whether or not this is complete.
Senator Morissette. Okay,
well, the tires is the easy part. It's the engine that is tough.
And the fuel.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's all I have for the committee.
Any further questions of Rob? Rob, we appreciate very much your understanding of the issue and the way you've worked with the powers that be to further the cause of charter schools in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I have just a...
Senator Deckard.
Thank you. And it's more of a comment, although you might know nationally, one of the things obviously we struggle with, and certainly it's a national issue, is the achievement gap. And I don't know if there's good examples of charter schools around the nation or here in Oregon that are showing some great strides in that arena or addressing, but certainly one I know that we wrestle with
here on this committee, and I'm interested if there are good examples of nationally or even here in Oregon that I just don't know about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, there are nationally for sure. In Oregon, it's a little bit premature to say honestly with good, strong data whether or not there is, because we really haven't had enough schools around for long enough to go through some of the cycles of assessment in the years that we assess kids to really get strong data on that. I will say, and this is somewhat ironic, the charter school, the first charter school in the Portland School District, the McCoy Academy, was showing incredible gains amongst their kids at the very time when the Portland School District decided not to renew its charter. And to wit, they had, this is a dropout retrieval program that takes kids who had already dropped out of one or more Portland district schools and alternative schools and brought them back into a charter school. They had a 16% dropout rate in the year that they were measured for their charter, compared to a district rate, I think that year was somewhere in the 30s, in the high 30s. And McCoy Academy had a 16% dropout rate. The district's assessment analysis of the school showed it had either fully or substantially met seven of nine benchmarks the district gave it, and it had partially or substantially met the other two. And these are all kids who are at risk because they've already dropped out of one or another school. It was doing a very good job, and it's kind of sad that the district decided not to renew its charter.
What was the district's, I know they're not here to explain themselves, but what was their rationale at the school boards?
They claimed that the two criteria that it didn't fully meet were sufficient for it to not renew the charter. And
criteria?
One of them was attendance rates. They required, I believe, a 90% attendance rate, and they were in the mid-80s, still higher than any other high school in a similar situation in Portland. And the other had to do with, I believe it was the accumulation of high school credits by the kids in the school. And that became more of a technical way of how the school gives credits and awards them, which didn't fit into the same style the way the district looks at them. And there was some question as to whether really, overall, in my opinion, if I can be brutally frank, it was a predetermined result, and the district was looking for a way to shut this charter school down. There's a long history of bad relationship between the operator of the district and the management of the school district, or operator of the charter school and the management of the school district, and that opinion was, I think, verified by the City Club report on charter schools, which came out about 5 months ago, which spent 8 pages talking about this very case and said that it appears the district rushed to judgment, possibly to a predetermined result, was the quote from the City Club's report. So, and I would concur with that.
And this is the one the State Board did unanimously certify for McCoy?
No, this is, no, that's a middle school. It's not yet started. This is when the state decided they could not, they did not have a role in overturning a district's decision not to renew. Hmm. And the statute doesn't give them that power, which it clearly does not. So,
Senator Marsette.
Yeah, thanks. Ron, do you have some information that you can give us in writing about how many, you know, listing the charter schools in the state? I'm kind of curious about where they are. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Marsette, I think Joni Gillis will have a complete list for you.
Okay. Yeah. And then the report that you mentioned for the City Club, is that available? Do you have copies of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marsette, it's available on their website. Okay. You can just download it, okay. And it's pdxcityclub.org.
Okay.
Good. Thanks. You again.
Thank you.
And will our other two witnesses come forward now? Please. Joni and Jim, thank you so much for...
Boy, I guess.
Well, 20 copies.
Oh.
That's all we request.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Board Association. What's being handed out to you is a packet of information that Joni and I created. And Joni and I, in the last 2 to 3 years, have spent some very good quality time together traveling the state of Oregon and helping school districts and charter applicants create their schools and work through the process. And we're going to cover some information for you today. I'm a little bit disappointed at the crowd here because I remember in 99 when we were doing the charter school bill, these hearing rooms were packed. And I think the chair of the House Education Committee reminded us last week when we did this presentation that Senate Bill 100, which created the charter schools, has the record for the most amendments of a bill ever in the legislature. I think there was almost 150 amendments. I looked back through the bill file, still in my desk. What I will talk you through very quickly, and then Joni will do some information as well on what the schools are that we currently have Senator Morissette and the federal issues. But on the back of the package there, you'll have this document. This is a document that we created at the Oregon School Boards Association for our school district boards on what they need to do to implement the charter school law. And I do want to also echo what Rob said. Oregon's unique in its charter school law in that, one, we were very careful when we crafted the law to make sure that charter schools in our state are public schools. They're public schools within the district in which they're created. We did that purposely. When that was done, the Oregon School Boards Association put its full support behind the bill, and we worked hard to make sure that that stayed in the bill. We've worked hard in the last 4 years now to ensure that the schools that we've created under the charter school law are good schools, and that the boards of our school districts have done their jobs in reviewing it and creating schools when they're good and denying them when they're not good schools. And one of the things we did in the law, and if you open up the pamphlet there to the first page, on that first page it says, what should the charter proposal contain? One of the things that we did in our law, and Mr. Sherman, you were very instrumental in creating that law, was with regard to what's in an application. This is a very rigorous process. This is not something that is done in 3 days' time, put before a school district board, and approved. This is a very rigorous process, and it is something that we're very proud of in our state, because when we look at other state laws, some of them don't have as rigorous of a process for the application. And as Joni and I tell crowds of folks or the boards or whoever we go to, we did that purposely because charter schools deal with two things that folks hold very near and dear to their heart, their kids and their money. And hopefully it's in that order as well. And if the school district or the charter school were to mess up with either one of those, it makes the newspapers. And it also makes it very well known to the school board in that school district. But you can see what the law does. You both of you and the rest of the committee have been through these hearings and have heard a lot about charter schools. One of the things that I do want to point out to you is the funding scenario. And I get a lot of questions on funding when we go to school districts across the state. And in the back of the packet, and the packet's about 22 pages, and believe me, we are not going to walk you through the entire packet. It's there for your late-time night reading when you have nothing else better to read. But on page 12 of the packet, a diagram that looks like this. Joni and the Department of Education put this together, and this is about the best visual I've ever seen on explaining how funding works. It's page 12 of the first part of the packet, Senator Morissette. Behind that, up until page 21, I believe, is some information that I produce, and this one was for the Siuslaw School District in Florence. And I do this for every district that we go to that we're called to do a presentation, and I walk them through the funding with their particular numbers. So the information here is Siuslaw. This is as of, this was pre-Measure 28, and the district's runs that were sent out, which are contained on page 20, assumed passage of ballot Measure 28 for the numbers they provide. Page 21 is the new updated information from the department after the failure of ballot Measure 28. But let me walk you through the funding very quickly, because it does get confusing, and I think that's where most of the questions have probably surrounded themselves at by legislators or at school districts that receive a charter school application. In the law, what we said was, for purposes of distribution of the state school fund, and remember what we talk about in distribution of state school fund dollars is where the student is a resident of. That has the key, that's the key in where the monies flow to. In charter school land, what we said was, wherever the student is attending the charter school, that student becomes a resident, except in one purpose, which is for special education. I'll get into that for a moment. That's even if the student's domicile, or where their parents live, is in another school district, because the charter school law is outside of our interdistrict transfer laws. That law requires both boards to approve a student, say, from Salem-Keizer going to the Dallas school district. Both Salem-Keizer and the Dallas board would have to approve that. In charter schools, if the Dallas district created a charter school, and my daughter, who attends school here in Salem-Keizer, wanted to go to that school in Dallas, that charter school, and every other Dallas student had the opportunity to attend, and there was still room available, my daughter could attend that school. She's not special education, so if she attends, the minute she enrolls, for purposes only of the state school fund, she becomes a resident of the Dallas school district. At that point, Dallas then makes the claim for the state school fund dollars. They pass through to the charter school whatever they've contracted for. In a K-8 environment, it's an 80% requirement of the general purpose grant per ADMW, and in a high school environment, grades 9 through 12, it's 95. But then they must send back to the Salem-Keizer district her what I would call true resident district, half of whatever they keep above that amount. So if they had, for sake of ease of math, it was $1,000 they got for her, and they gave $800 to the charter school, they kept $200. They would have to send $100 back to Salem-Keizer. We did that for two reasons, essentially. One, because if my daughter leaves Salem-Keizer, that does not mean the ongoing costs of the district have gone down because one child leaves. Two, if anything happens in that charter school that either myself as a parent or she doesn't like, we can leave at any time. She would then be eligible for enrollment back at Salem-Keizer. Or if the school shuts down mid-year, Salem-Keizer has to take her back. That's the idea of a public school. She lives here. She would have the opportunity to go there. That's why we did that. With IDEA, or special education children, children that are on an IEP, we did a little bit different than what other states did, and we attended a national conference three years ago. Rob, Joni, myself, and some other folks around the state attended a national conference of the issue of charter schools and special ed, because that was a real hot issue at that time. How do we treat children who have a federal right to an education in these public schools? And we walked away with the mantra the Oregon team did, saying, we're not you guys, because they did everything from soup to nuts across the nation. They said, for purposes of federal IDEA, you charter school are the local education agency, the LEA, and under the federal law, they're the individuals that have responsibility for providing that special education. What we said in Oregon is the resident district is the district responsible for that. So in the instance I gave you of Salem-Keizer Dallas, if my daughter was on an IEP, Salem-Keizer would maintain the funding and the responsibility for the special ed portion. My daughter could still enroll in the Dallas Charter School if there was room available. After all, Dallas kids were given the opportunity, and it was a proper placement for her for services to be provided for the rest of her education. Salem-Keizer, because they get a double weight, and charter school land does not take into consideration the 11% cap we have for special education, Salem-Keizer has to send over to that charter school 40% of the double weight for an elementary minimally, and 47.5% of the double weight for a high school. That equals out to the 80% that's there for a non-IEP and 95% for that. The idea is that additional weight's there for special education services. What's required is Salem-Keizer enters into a contract with that charter school to send them that amount of money. Salem-Keizer then has the responsibility for the special ed portion. They can contract with that charter school to provide those services if they believe that the charter school can do that. They can contract with the ESD. They could go to the community college, wherever they want, just like they can normally. But we did that so that Salem-Keizer keeps the responsibility, because in no way whatsoever would you want to force the Dallas School District to take a student with special education needs that that district has never had responsibility for and may not have the ability to serve at that particular time. That would be an onerous to put on that district. So we kept it with the resident district, and thus far it has worked way better than we ever imagined, and it works way better than other states that have done different things. It's a little cumbersome, admittedly, on the money, but I believe it works best in our state, and addresses the issues that the districts were concerned about, as well as the advocates for students with disabilities. I would echo
Senator Morissette has a question,
sure.
And I also.
Okay, thanks. It just seems to me that charter schools, unless they are set up to deal with students with disabilities, are not the place to deal with that. I mean, my question, how many charter schools were set up to deal with students with disabilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, right now we have 23 charter schools. None of them were particularly set up to deal with students with a particular disability or with disabilities in general. However, we do have charter schools that have students on IEPs that are attending charter schools in Oregon. They are not what I would call the most severe disabled students that have real high costs associated with them. Most of them are LD, learning disabled.
Okay.
But they are addressing those needs, working with the resident district as well as the sponsoring district, if they're not the same district, to ensure that the federal law is met student's IEP is met and that they're making educational gains. And thus far, the students that we've seen that are in there on IEPs, those goals are being met. And the IEP goal is being met. It requires a lot of partnership between the charter school and that school district, but it's working.
Can I follow up on this? Are they ever required to take a student with disabilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore said no. Remember, charter schools are schools of choice. So it's a choice on the parent.
Okay, so...
And the IEP team is still there to make sure that that's a proper placement for that student.
Okay, that's, I guess, answers my question. Okay.
My question's related to that, a little different. The IEP student has double weighting, as you pointed out, and the advocate or the team that put together to make sure services are delivered. Have we some assurances that the double-weighted funding follows the student, or is that different according to the level of...
Well, remember, Mr. Chairman, our funding formula is not a spending formula. It's a distribution formula.
That's why I'm asking my question.
And the double weight recognizes what the average costs are for special education kids across the state. And I can tell you, we have in some districts, and you will see some audited data as you read that special ed task force report, I think, which has been presented to you or will be, has not yet been. And they have information in there that some districts have kids that are nine times the normal weighting for students in the state, but then some of their kids in their district may be only 1.3 times as much. So it's try to address the average. But what happens is that district has to enter into the contract with the charter school to put the funding over there, and the IEP still needs to be met. Whether it costs more than that additional weight or whether it costs less, the services still have to be provided to meet the IEP and the IEP goals. That may be more than 2.0, maybe 2.0, or maybe less.
That answers my question.
Well, okay.
Senator Marks,
I guess my original question really wasn't answered. Now, let's say that a student moves in from another state. There's no history of special needs, and that student wants to attend a charter school, so the student is accepted. But upon further testing, they recognize some difficulties. Now, at what point may the charter school say, no, we can't deal with your difficulties? Now, they could contract... They could stay at the charter school, and they would have the money to go ahead and contract to meet their needs. But I guess what I'm getting at is, at what point can a charter school simply say, we are not set up to handle the kinds of minor problems even that you may have, and therefore you can't come to this charter school?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, that may depend a little bit, because in some instances that charter school may never be able to say, we can't handle that.
Okay.
And because they're public schools in Oregon, that's the uniqueness of this issue. Okay. If a student moves in from out of state, and at the time they enroll and they get there, they're suspected of some sort of disability, they're referred, the charter school would refer them to the resident district to say, we need to have an evaluation done as to whether they're eligible. If they're determined to be eligible, and the charter school says, well, we can't serve them, and the parents say, that's tough, we want that student there, then the state put provisions of the federal law. If the parents want to push the issue to say, we don't care, you have to serve them, you're a public school, the state put provisions of IDEA require that until a determination is made that that is not a proper placement, the state put provisions would say, charter school, you keep that student because the last known placement was you, and you must now determine whether, in fact, that's a proper placement. The charter school would be forced to keep that kid in those instances. If the IEP team gets together, and the parent now is a member of the IEP team under the federal law, and they determine that the placement is not proper, but the parents push it, that's the case. In most instances in that situation, we haven't had that come up. Generally, there is some agreement tried to work out that student can attend there for some of it, but if the proper placement is held that it's not a proper placement, then there would be an order entered to send the student to the proper placement as the IEP team determined. That's very technical. But
well,
yeah. Thank you.
That was very helpful.
I want to conclude very quickly, just to echo what Mr. Kramer has said. We have worked very hard to form the partnership that we have at the state level. He is correct. I've checked with every one of our associations that have a charter school law. We are the only school board association across the nation to support the charter school law that's currently enacted in their state. That's a unique position. Sometimes some of our districts don't like that position, but it's the position that our board and our legislative policy committee has taken. We have worked very hard to form our partnership with the Department of Education, Joni and her staff, as well as Rob Kramer and John Liljegren at the Oregon Charter School Service Center. And I think the three groups have done a great deal to make this an active law. For those of you that visit educational websites, I happen to do that on a regular basis. The Center for Educational Reform, which generally is not one of isn't generally that favorable towards certain things in public education, I guess would be a nice way to say it, ranks charter school laws on a yearly basis. And in the beginning, it was believed that Oregon didn't have a very active law. Well, there wasn't a clamoring to start these charter schools, but now Jeannie Allen and the group at the Center for Educational Reform gives Oregon a strong B to B plus grade on charter schools and sees us as a very active state. And I would say we are a very active state. Joni and I think this year, last year and a half, about 3,000 miles together in the vehicle, traveling around the state to do charter school presentations to school district boards. I can attest personally that this is a very active state with regard to it. We have a service center at OSBA. You're looking at the sole employee of the OSBA Charter School Service Center. That's one of the services that we provide. But it has been a very good partnership. And originally, there was concerns whether the partnership would be formed. But the three groups have worked very well together. We've worked very hard at creating good charter schools. We've denied some, and rightfully so, I believe, when they've been denied. You have three denials, and I think Joni's going to talk about that, that have gone up on appeal to the state board. As Rob mentioned, we have a state-sponsored charter school now. I don't believe the charter has been drafted yet or the contract has been drafted, but that shows that the law is active. In the middle of this pamphlet is the flow chart of how a charter school becomes a charter school and the timelines. And actually, there's a more up-to-date one in the pamphlet because there's a 15-day requirement that Rob mentioned. But we've worked our way all the way through this flowchart almost now in 4 years, and it's right down here on the far bottom right where the state board sponsors. The only step that's left would be for the state board to deny one and then appeal to the circuit court here in Marion County, and the court would order the state board to become the sponsor. So our law works, and it's very active. And I would say, Rob said 12 more schools this year. That may be low. We may have 15 to 16 more charter schools, and one of the reasons is the No Child Left Behind law. I think Joni's going to talk about that because school districts are starting to want to start these to use as alternative programs to address unique needs of kids, and if they're not making adequate yearly progress in a No Child Left Behind, the charter school may be one of the placements that's available for students in the district to use it. So we're seeing more districts want to start it, and I'll turn it over to Joni. She's going to give you the statewide context and the federal grants.
Just one more quick question. And sure. I was the vice chair of the House subcommittee, or the House Education Committee in 99, and I went through that whole argument. And during the interim, there was a situation that arose, and I remember Senator Hartung was quoted in the Oregonian saying, well, and I think the incident was around a for-profit organization that was providing something, and he said, well, the law didn't make provisions for that particular issue, and it had to do with charter schools. Do you remember that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, there was a proposal in Portland Public School District. This was right, I think, in 1999, right when the law first passed. And there was a question about whether a charter school could contract with a for-profit group. We had that looked at. We gave it to the Attorney General, and he ruled on that and said that, yes, our law interpreted it, that our law allowed for a charter school to contract with a for-profit group. That charter school has not, they haven't done anything with that, so they're not chartered now, but that was kind of a test case to see if a district could even sponsor a charter that was going to contract with for-profit.
So that is not being done as yet, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, it's legal, but we haven't had anybody move forward and be granted an actual charter. But it is legal.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, that issue is generally dealt with in the negotiations for the charter or the contract. Because the application comes from the group and they're going to initially run it, at least in the districts that I represent, I suggest that they put a clause in the contract that says for the term of this charter, the charter entity will not subcontract out, because the district should know who they're dealing with. Yeah. And if it's the case that they're going to contract subcontract it out, then you're going to draft an agreement that would look totally different than a normal charter school contract. So in most instances, that is dealt with in the charter or contract agreement, which is the key to the operation of the charter school, because once the board approves it and they create that contract, anything that happens, whether it goes wrong, and we've closed some, that contract is the controlling document.
That is the charter.
Mm-hmm. Contract or charter, we use those terms interchangeably, so don't let me confuse that. They're the document that the two parties enter into to create that school.
Thank you. Joni.
Mr. Chair, I'm Joni Gillis from the Department of Education, and I'm very pleased that we have four staff members now at ODE working on charter schools, because we are extremely busy. As both Rob and Jim have said, it's an active law, lots of business throughout the state, and we provide services to school districts, to charter developers, and help just in the implementation of the law. Let me give you a little bit of the statewide context. We have 23 schools that are currently operating. About 2,500 students in Oregon attend charter schools. We have 8 charter proposals that have been approved by their local districts that will be opening in the fall of 2003, and we probably have another maybe 8 to 10 that are somewhere in the works of the going through the charter proposal process. Rob spoke a little bit about Four Rivers Charter School in Ontario School District, a unique charter school, dual language immersion. I just want to mention a few other ones so you can kind of get an idea of the different kinds of focus that the charter schools have and also the different student groups that they're targeting. We have a very unique proposal out of the East Counties up in Portland. It's Gresham, Barlow, Reynolds, Centennial, Corbett, and the Mountain Hood Community College, and that is a consortium of districts that have come together, and they want to have a program that is going to focus on medical health careers for high school students, pre-engineering, hospitality, tourism, and informational technology. And they've been 2.5 years, I think, in the works, and they're scheduled to open in 2003, the fall of 2003. Really unique, exciting proposal. They're going to need lots of waivers from the state board, but I think that's the beauty of the charter school law, that it's going to allow lots of flexibility.
Senator Morissette.
Okay. I've been to the Saban Skills Center a couple times, and this sounds something like that. I think the Saban Skills Center, they have people who are not certified. They're probably teaching under the director of a teacher. But I know that one time we were there and they had an architect who was teaching.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, that's correct. The Saban Skills Center is in the North Clackamas School District, okay. and it was formed under the alternative education laws. This is the Center for Advanced Learning, and they are formed under the charter school law because it's four school districts and the community college coming together. Two of those school districts, by the way, went to their voters and got bonds passed to build the charter school building.
Wow.
So it is truly an ability of four districts to come together to use the law where they saw a need, not in each individual district to the level that they could fund a program to do it, but when they looked at all of them around, and they're all contiguous districts, they said, there's a real need here. And if we form a partnership of the five of us together, we could address the needs. And they did so under the charter school law. And remember, the charter school law, Senator Morissette, requires that 50% of the FTE have a valid teaching license.
Right.
And what we're seeing actually in the charter schools in Oregon, it's upwards of about 80 to 90% of the staffs in charter schools have a valid TSPC license. So it's one of those things that we didn't envision this type of school when we crafted the law. We didn't envision Paisley either. But it worked its way into it, and it's going to create a good program for kids, and the voters of all of the districts and parents are supportive, as well as the business community in that area.
Super. This is a senior high program, or is it a junior high, senior high?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is a senior high program.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morrison.
Senator Decker.
Excuse me.
Well, I didn't know if you were completed, so I'll let you finish. My question was just at general, and you might even get to it in your testimony, of how we're doing. I think all of us worked on this bill when it came through, and how is it addressing the needs that the proponents indicated that it might?
Mr. Chair, should I finish and then?
Yes,
okay.
Please.
So we've got 2,500 students that are attending charter schools, with between 8 and maybe 16 more opening next year. We've had one that has been terminated by its school district, and we've had two that have not been renewed. Mr. Kramer spoke about one, McCoy Academy. We've had another one that was not renewed because of for attendance. They weren't able to. The law requires 25 students, and they weren't able to come up with the 25 students. We've had three that have been submitted to the state to have the state board become a sponsor of the charter school. One of those, as both Jim and Rob have spoken to, the state board took a very important step in approving the proposal, and now there's going to be negotiations on the charter school. So Victory Middle School in Portland Public will most probably be the first charter school in the state that's sponsored by the state board, and we have two more that are at the state board for sponsorship. In terms of accountability, that seems to be the name of the game lately, and charter schools are extremely accountable. That's one of the basic premises of charter schools, is they're freed from many of the rules and regulations, but they have to show results. They're accountable. First of all, they all have goals written into their charter. They agree to meeting certain goals with their local school districts. Many of those goals have to do with student achievement, so that their test scores will be as good or better than the average district scores, or that their attendance will be higher than, or their dropout rate will be lower than. So they're accountable to their local school districts, because their charter could not be renewed if they did not meet the goals. They're held accountable externally because they're schools of choice, and if they do not provide for what they promise, parents, students will not choose to attend, and staff may not choose to teach there. They're also accountable to No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind includes charter schools because they're public schools. So AYP charter schools are held responsible for adequate yearly progress, for highly qualified teachers, paraprofessionals. All the sanctions that are part of No Child Left Behind would also apply to charter schools. As Rob has said, the baseline data, we're just collecting baseline data for charter schools. They're 3 years old. They have to take all the state assessments, and they will also be getting a state or a school report card. And what they don't have overall ratings yet on the report card, because they have to have 4 years worth of data to be able to give them an overall rating. But and just the preliminary studies that we've done on the charter schools that are in existence. Generally speaking, the elementary schools have done as good or better than on the state assessments, some of them scoring extremely high. Our charter high schools, on average, are lower than the district and state average. However, our charter school high schools really serve the at-risk, the very vulnerable population. So just that they're back, that they've brought them back into schools, I think is a real credit to them. If we took a look at the charter high schools and compared them to alternative schools in the state, I think they would, score fairly, probably a little bit higher than those. One thing that I think we're going to see happening is that the charter schools, once they are 3 years old, they after they've completed their third year, they're eligible for a dissemination grant. So those charter schools that have shown that they've closed the achievement gap, or they've done some really great things for our most at-risk students, will be able to apply for a grant to develop, to collect collect their best practices and then disseminate those to other charter schools and other public schools throughout the state. And I think that's where we're going to see some really exciting things happening. They're going to have to show evidence that they have closed the achievement gap or you know, done some excellent things with our most needy students, and then be able to assist other schools in doing that. And there'll be some funds to assist with that. Let's see. In terms of No Child Left Behind, like I said, if they receive Title I funds, then immediately all the requirements of No Child Left Behind this year applied to charter schools. Our grant, I think that's probably one of the most attractive pieces of the charter school movement, is that we received we had received $9 million over the last 3 years to assist charter developers in the planning, development, and implementation of their schools. And we just received, as of October 1st, another $15 million. It's $5 million over the course of 3 years. To continue assisting charter schools as they develop, as they implement, and then as they disseminate the best practices. We have the charter school, we have a planning grant that in the amount of $50,000. And this assists the charter schools in developing their proposal that they then give to their local school districts. Once they are approved, their district has approved their proposal, then they're eligible for $150,000 of incentive grant money for the first year and another $150,000 for that second year. And those funds are to be used for materials, supplies, equipment, professional development, all of the kinds of activities that would go into starting a school.
Those funds don't seem to be adequate for capital expenditures, and this is one of the drawbacks of trying to start a charter, is finding facilities that you can live with and fund. Any thought long term about dealing with that issue?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Jim Green with the School Boards Association again. A couple things have gone on in this state that make it a little bit unique. I mentioned the fact that two districts in a district-sponsored one issued bonds to build a building. In a couple of the other charter schools that are on the list that Joni provided you, on the ones that are created in the state, one of the issues that charter schools got started around in this state, and again, we didn't envision this when we created the law, but it became a reality as we walked through this process. If you take a look at the Dallas School District, Philomath School District, I'm trying to think of the other. The charter school there, it's Kings Valley and in PD in Dallas. Those were existing public elementary schools, and at Detroit Lake up at Santiam Canyon that they did close because it didn't have the 25 students. Those were existing public school elementary buildings. Because of the way the funding worked for those districts, the board, the community of those districts said, we can no longer afford to keep those schools open. There's just not the bodies out there. We're going to ask you to bus in. Those community groups, those parents, those are outlying schools, said, that's unacceptable. We lose the heart of our community if you shut this school down. They use the charter school law. The districts in those instances, through negotiations, entered into some unique agreements. They gave them the building, rented it to them for $1 a year, and the charter school folks do the upkeep on the building. They maintain it, they paint it, they make sure it's heated, those type of things. Any major renovations, obviously, they need to work through the district. That's one scenario that we're seeing. The other scenario is, as school districts close school buildings, we're seeing that charter school folks are interested in using those facilities. Now, whether the district has sold the property or interested in renting it or saying it's surplus, we'll let you have it at a discount, that's one area. The other thing I wanted to make you aware of, Mr. Chairman, is that in President Bush's budget for this current year, not only the one he proposed yesterday, the one they had proposed for this year is not final yet, if you're not aware of that. And in his budget, he had $200 million earmarked for facility usage for charter schools. You're right, Mr. Chairman. It's one of the biggest issues that charter school folks face if they don't have an available facility with working with their district or given to them by some benefactor. And President Bush attempted to address that by putting $200 million in his budget for that purpose, only for facilities, the ability to rent, renovate, purchase, what have you. And we're yet to see that come through and whether it's going to come to fruition. But if it does, Oregon will be at the forefront of going after that money. We're very aggressive in getting grant money. Oregon, Joni's been very good at that. We received a $15 million grant just recently for charter schools. I'm assuming we would go after that. With our law being very active, we would get that money. But it is one of the other things that charter schools face. Remember, in our law, you also created the revolving loan account. That is a zero-interest loan that is at the Department of Education, and the administrator of that loan is sitting right next to me here. That's with the federal grant money, and that money can also be available for certain purposes. Facilities, I don't believe, fits the criteria, but Joni may be able to address that a little more. She's the loan officer here on this program, so...
Mr. Chair, yes, we do have a revolving loan program. That's one of the components of the federal grant. And it's right now it's a $25,000 no-interest loan, and it can be used for any of the activities that the grant can't be used for. So facilities is one of them. So it could be to put a new roof on a building. We've had two loans that we have approved. And have granted, and they need to repay them within the length of their charter. So I think more charter schools are going to be looking at that. It's still $25,000 isn't, you know, quite enough to do a lot of the work that needs to be done in facilities. One school is going to use it to buy a van or a bus or something for transportation that their loan funds weren't able to use those for.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
What about the Howard Street School? We visited that site in 99. Is that still alive and well?
Former principal of that school is right here. She was the principal when you visited,
well,
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris said, yes, it is in its fifth year. In fact, they received their first report card this year, and they had all strongs. They have a waiting list of 130 students.
Wow.
It's doing extremely well.
And you still teach dance, PE, right?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, remember when that school you visited, when you visited that school, we didn't have a charter school law. That school was created under the alternative ed program. They have switched. They have converted to charter school status, which you allowed under the law just recently. Mm-hmm. The Salem-Keizer Board approved that, signed a contract, and they are now a true charter school under our law. And Joni was the principal when you visited.
Okay. They still teach dance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said, yes, they do.
That is wonderful.
They teach dance instead of PE. You will not find a basketball at that school. You will find lots of tutus.
What's so wonderful about that, Ryan? It's good exercise.
And, Mr. Chairman, if
it's
I can
universal form
Decker's
of
question,
PE.
Please. How is the law working? It's working very well. And we're creating schools that are doing good things for students. And you may, if you take a look at the report card, as Joni said, you won't see information because you need 4 years of baseline data to take a look at that. And even if you were to look at students' test scores, take the Lourdes Charter School down in the Scioto School District. Every one of their students is above benchmarks, to the point of like 93% above benchmark. It's astounding what that school is doing. The same is true in some of the other ones. We have some charter schools, if you look at their test scores, none of the students met the benchmark. But that school is addressing a need that community wants, and the value of that charter school is simply the kids are in school and they're learning and they're at least taking the assessments. Most of these students that I'm talking about in these charter schools had never been in school before or dropped out, and the school wasn't addressing their needs. They are meeting their needs, and if you took a look at the growth for the student, there was growth from where they were originally to where they're at. The success story there is, one, that the kids are in school, two, that they want to be in school and they're excited about learning, and that they're sitting for the state tests and they're growing. Now, you could go ahead and just take a look at the test scores and say, well, they're not meeting benchmark. That's not the goal of that charter school. So before you just compare the test scores and say they're not there, you've got to look at the individual charter and the population of kids they're serving. And one more comment I'd say on the partnership. Rob mentioned that there's an issue with the 15 days and how that may work and whether you have a complete application. He mentioned that we may be able to take care of that in other ways. One of the other ways is through administrative rule. Joni and the department formed the Oregon Charter School Task Force that includes a variety of folks across the state. Rob has been on it. I've been on it. School district individuals are on it. People that run charter schools are on it.
OEA.
OEA is on there. And OEA has been a very good partner in that charter school task force in addressing the needs of their members and bringing things to the forefront. So it is truly a partnership that spans the educational community in the state. And Senator Deckert, if I had to guess, I think a couple of years from now, we'd probably be looking at 50 to 60 charter schools, and hopefully they're all doing good things. One of the things in the packet is the evaluation that a school board has to do. When I said the application process is tough, the review process is tough, and it should be. It should be rigorous, but because of the way we crafted our law, and you were all three in the legislature when this occurred, you remembered all the work that went into this. We crafted a law, and it took a long time to do it, but we created a good law that's creating good schools. The ones that haven't been good, they've been dealt with because we created a law that allowed that to happen.
Jim, are there innovations that you think we could transfer to our traditional public school system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckert, that's going on daily within school districts that have charter schools within them, just to address the needs of kids that there's a population there, but they didn't believe they had a core population to create a whole new program. They're finding that that school can address those needs and also show some things to that school district that they may not have been doing in the past to meet the needs of those kids. The other thing is, if a kid doesn't want to be in a normal classroom, some of these aren't normal classrooms. If you take a look at some of the applications, and I've seen every one of them across the state pretty much now, one in Eugene is a program that's going to collectively take a look at all the alternative programs in the city and be a referral agency to all those programs for each unique individual. And there are very unique programs. There's alternative transportation, which is a program that Senator Morissette's familiar with it. And I think in a lot of instances, Senator Deckert, the districts have learned a lot, and they've tried to address those needs of those kids. And one of the things that I've told districts is, if you have a group of parents that want to start a charter school and they have 120 applicants for it, that should tell you something. And you should listen to those folks and try to start the programs that address their needs.
Just a comment, and then I'll quit. If all of the districts were as progressive as 4J and Eugene, there would not be a charter school program in the state of Oregon. And I said it at the time, but other districts were not as flexible. And so I think Eugene has always been a model of alternative schools and now charter schools. Mm-hmm. But, no, I'm impressed. I really am. And I do have a question that I'd like to ask you after we finish.
Before we wind this up, I wanted to get on the record comments and maybe get a response from you. 3 months ago, I got a book in the mail that said the students at ECOT taught. And ECOT was chartered in April of 2000 by an education service district in the state of Ohio, and by September they'd enrolled 2,000 students. By the end of the year they had 3,000 students enrolled. They thought, because this was the electronic classroom of tomorrow, ECOT, that they would be signing up mostly homeschoolers. In fact, they found that 90% of their students came from both ends of the bell curve. And they reached many students who, for whatever reason, for many reasons, students leave high school early, but decide after they leave that they really would like to complete their education. So they signed up students from 604 of the 614 school districts in the state of Ohio and taught them 24/7. So that the single mom who left school because having a child now could work full time and finish her education after midnight or whenever it fit her schedule. There is a charter management company out of Dallas, Texas that are presently visiting Oregon, and they're going to be on our and make a presentation to the Education Committee. I think that there are opportunities that are just really exciting that we're aware of. And what do you know about
Mr. Chairman, we have not yet addressed the issue of a cyber charter school in our state. There have been some that have, that Joni and I talked to a group that thought about starting one. Or I talked to them individually, and then I suggested they talk to Joni. They did not go forward with that. There have been other states that have addressed that issue of a cyber charter school, and in our law, it would be possible to create a cyber charter school, one that, you know, you don't have the traditional schoolhouse, but the kids are learning at home or at a facility where there is an online ability. The difficulty may be in the definition of the 25 students, but I think we could probably work around that issue. The other issue would be if they're not taking their full curriculum there, but they're completing their high school and they're only taking advantage of a couple hours worth of class. You probably wouldn't want to require that district to send the full amount of the money over there if the student's also taking classes, but we've worked through that with waivers. And currently, we have those programs in our state right now. The Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD runs a cyber school for kids all around the state, and they take advantage of classes that are not available in there. The Douglas ESD also runs a program where...
Sabin Center
also. Salem Kaiser Online is a program that also services kids statewide. And the nice thing is they've done that without the charter school law because there was a need. And the one in Douglas County, they have some really small school districts down there. Days Creek, actually, they called us down to look at a charter district for them. But they had a student that was taking college-level calculus through their program from the Douglas ESD from a professor or a teacher instructor at the Umpqua Community College. They're in their classroom at the Umpqua Community College teaching to the class, and the student's in Days Creek, and it's run through the ESD. And it also meets with kids in Coos and Curry County as well. So we're doing that currently within our existing structure without a charter school.
And Mr. Chair, Salem Kaiser Online, they have applied for a planning grant and did receive a planning grant. They've changed a component of their school to its Expedition Charter School. And I believe Salem Kaiser, if they didn't last week approve their charter, they're
taking it next board.
Okay, at the next board meeting. So we're starting to see some real out-of-the-box thinking in terms of virtual schools. And it also in terms of some creative approaches to working with the homeschool population.
And we've done that through the task force with Joni by making some changes in administrative rules. And we've also done it by that waiver provision that's in our law. As long as they meet that list of unwaivables, everything else in the law is waivable by the state board if it makes good educational practice and sound practice for boys and girls.
It's exciting.
Even I'm excited.
Hey. Not even a charter school supporter. Now he's...
Well, I'm learning a lot today, and I think, you know, I really like that Sabin model and that you're doing that, and, you know, that needs to be expanded. Oh, go ahead. Bye.
We're going to adjourn the Senate Education Committee, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just have a question.